Okay, we are at 2:46. Moving right along, we've gone through 4 sentences. But I think it's important to keep, you feel how dense this stuff is, and there's so much implied that if you don't know it, you don't see what he's dealing with. So it is no miracle. It was so from the beginning. My wisdom and my daughter are one. That's Elijah. I'm shocked. I'm incapable of grasping it. Well, you're in good company. Yeah. Elijah, consider this. Her blindness and my sight have made us companions through eternity. Now, what's the relationship between the blindness and sight? I've kind of said it, but there's another little implication here. She's going to develop coming up. Anyone intuit where they're going? Well, the idea is you don't always know what you're getting into when you live your instincts. But that's no reason not to do it. So in a way, she is always blind. At least at the beginning. As we get older, remember, he's not even, what, he's 35 years old here. Is that right? 19, yeah. Well, 30, he's 38 years old. So he's still the testosterone kid. And I'm not sure he ever stopped being the testosterone kid.
I don't think so. You see older pictures of him, you know, at conferences, he's got that little
twinkle
in his eye.
A little sexy turn to his head.
Yeah.
But it's bringing up that you can't always figure things out before you live them. Sometimes you got to live them looking, you know, after some burns. Okay, I don't see any real train wrecks here. I don't know how it's going to end up. If reason says, you know, I'm not going to get into it until I know how it's going to end up, you'll never get wise. And I think that's part of this thing he's coming upon, that desire is always somewhat blind. Or it's blind and you get into one situation and you become wise and then you think you've achieved wisdom and then you have another situation and you're blind again and so on.
Could be husband after husband,
business deal after business deal. Again, we try to learn from our mistakes as much as we can in analytic work, but there's never a guarantee. And I think that's what he's driving at here. And as we'll see coming up pretty soon, this idea of the old man and young woman is an archetype. So this is not about Jung's personal psychology. As he's going to work with it, this is the new Western myth of creating value through instinct.
So that pair you see is a rechanneling of the archetype of meaning.
I would say
that expression of the old man, or is that a age-old
That's an
pair.
Age-old image of meaning lost to Christianity, because the form he's going to refer to is Gnostic.
What's an age-old image? I'm sorry.
The old man and young woman. The old wise man and the young lascivious woman. The reference he's going to go to is, as I mentioned, we'll get to it, Simon Magus and Helen. Helen is a Gnostic image who was, and Simon Magus rescued her from a brothel in Tyre, and then they traveled together. No, that's Gnostic. See, that was all excluded as heretical. And Helen, that Helen is the same Helen as the Helen of Troy. I mean, in the mythic mind. So you see that, you remember what shall I say, seductive and beautiful and troublesome woman Helen of Troy was. She got hundreds of guys killed fighting for her beauty. Okay, forgive my astonishment. Am I truly in the underworld? Salome, do you love me? How can I love you? How do you come to this question? I see only one thing. You are, Salome, a tiger. Your hands are stained with the blood of the Holy One. How should I love you? So there he's fighting the whole experience. He realizes how dangerous his instincts can be, what they can lead him into. Salome says, you will love me. I love you. Who gives you the right to such thoughts? Salome, I love you. I, leave me be. I dread you, you beast. Salome, you do me wrong. Elijah is my father, and he knows the deepest mysteries. That is true. The walls of his house are made of precious stones. His wells hold healing water, and his eyes see things of the future. We're going to be talking about forethought in a moment. And what wouldn't you give for a single look into the infinite unfolding of what is to come? Are these not worth a sin for you? Kapowie. Remember the spirit of the time, spirit of the depths. He's the spirit of the depths now. And if you could go through a process and develop greater insight, which might save lives of others, is it worth a sin? That's what he's wrestling with.
He says the upward fall, the idea of the upward fall, which is where even the serpent come in, that sin is going to creep. What you're doing is going to create something
better. Exactly. And I think that's so important to remember, and why, you know, talking about this stuff, as I may have mentioned, but some of you haven't heard it, publicly, is a little dangerous, because it could easily be taking a fall down. We have so much of that going on now. God, economics, golf, oil. I mean, just think of the hideous irresponsibilities that are populating our news. But this is a fall up. You know, I know you guys don't feel this way, but I have been really attacked when I've been out speaking publicly. You know, what a bastard he was, and faithful to his wife, and which is true. I mean, he wasn't dishonest, as I said. Well, I can tell you five people who are alive today because of Jungian psychology that wouldn't have been without it. I've seen them in my practice, and I couldn't have worked with them had I not known what Jung discovered then. So that's, I think, what he's meaning, is it not worth a sin to be able to see what does the future mean? And he paid that price. That's what they forget. Your temptation is devilish. I long to be back in the upper world. It is dreadful here. How oppressive and heavy is the air. Elijah, what do you want? The choice is yours. But I do not belong to the dead. I live in the light of day. Why should I torment myself here with Salome? Do I not have enough of my own life to deal with? That's what you were referring to, Sandy.
I think it's interesting to me that he is actually tempted by her. I mean, just like the bloodthirsty woman, you know, and then she comes out and he's not really, this seems like he's very attracted to her and very tempted
by
all of her.
But he goes with her, eventually.
But he doesn't seem like he's really, you know, like dancing around that. How strongly the temptation is.
I think both are true. The temptation is very strong. He doesn't care. On the other hand, he cares very much. Have you ever seen the movie Chinatown?
Yeah.
There's a line at the very end. John Ford, I think, he directed it and played in it. Character says to the, who's the other guy? Jack Gibson character, whose name is Geddes. Mr. Geddes, very few people ever realize that under the right in the right time and under the right circumstances, they are capable of doing just anything. I think that's what was coming up here. If we throw away morality, what's left? Elijah, you heard what Salome said. I cannot believe that you, the prophet, can recognize her as a daughter and a companion. Is she not engendered from hyena seed? That's what I was referring to earlier. Hyenas, the incestuous relationship with her uncle who... Wait a minute. She was married to first her uncle, one uncle, and then she marries another uncle. Was she not vain, greed, and criminal lust? Roger, but she loved the holy man. Aye, and shamefully shed his precious blood. Elijah, she loved the prophet who announced the new God to the world. Elijah, she loved the prophet who announced the new God to the world. She loved him, do you understand that? For she is my daughter. Aye, do you think that because she's your daughter, she loved the prophet in John the father? Elijah, by her love shall you know her. Aye, but how did she love him? Do you call that love? What else was it? I am horrified. Who wouldn't be horrified if Salome loved him? Meaning, if she loves you, she kills you. Elijah, are you cowardly? Consider this. I and my daughter have been one since eternity. There is the archetypal aspect of it, I think. Pleasure and wisdom working together. And that's what Jung is trying to solve. You pose dreadful riddles. How could it be that this unholy woman and you, the prophet of God, could be one? That's what he's going to try to unravel, the relationship between these two, practically, in therapy, and in his life. Elijah, why are you amazed? But you see it, we are together. What my eyes see is exactly what I cannot grasp. You, Elijah, who are a prophet, the mouth of God, and she, a bloodthirsty horror. You are the symbol of the most extreme contradiction. Elijah, we are real and not symbols. Where does that come from?
Where does it come from?
Yeah, I mean...
What does it lead to?
Yeah, what's it really saying?
The reality of the psyche.
You've got to live this stuff out if you're going to figure it out, I think.
Or that, you know, people saying, oh, it's just psychological, and he refuted that.
Right.
And it's also alive. I think the fact that they're living creatures, symbols aren't living.
Or that there is a symbolic meaning to be learned, but only by living. Later in the Zarathustra seminar, some of you remember that quote, I think it's there, where Jung says, visions. Sometimes you can pay in wine, sometimes you have to pay in blood. It's not always your decision.
Never your
decision.
That's vision.
Is that visions? So here, that idea of paying in wine, which would mean simply solving the problem in your imagination versus living it out and then picking up the pieces. That hasn't occurred to him. That's even possible. I think that's what Jungian psychology is trying to give us, given a complicated emotional situation. Is it possible to solve it totally in active imagination, or does it have to be lived out? I think he's given us tools to try to live it out in the imagination. Sometimes it's not enough, and as he says, it's not always up to decide. Always up to us to decide. Okay. I see how the black serpent, we've kind of forgotten about him, rise up the tree and hides in the branches. Everything becomes gloomy and doubtful. Elijah rises, I follow, and we go silently back through the hall. Doubt tears me apart. It is all so unreal, and yet a part of my longing remains behind. See, this is what he keeps coming back to. What I long for. Not what is reasonable to long for, not what I should long for, but what I long for. Will I come again? Salome loves me. Do I love her? I hear wild music, a tambourine, a sultry moonlit night, the blood staring head of the Holy One. Fear seizes me. I rush out. I am surrounded by the dark night. It is pitch black all around. Who murdered the hero? Is this why Salome loves me? Remember the murder of the hero. Do I love her, and did I therefore murder the hero? She is one with the prophet, one with John, but also one with me. Woe, was she the hand of God? Hand of the God? I do not love her. I fear her. Then the spirit of the depths spoke to me and said, therein you acknowledge her divine power. Must I love Salome?
So he says, was she the hand of God?
Hand of the God.
Hand of the God. Is he referring to when she had John the Baptist slain? Or is he referring to her in her present relation to him?
I think she's referring to her in her present relationship to him.
Because that's puzzling that she would slay the prophet of the new God image.
Right. It doesn't say it, so we can only guess. It's like she kills, in the Bible, she kills the representative of the new God image. John the Baptist announces Christ.
Mm-hmm.
He kills the representative of the old God image.
Mm-hmm.
Does she care whether she's killing an old God image or a new God image? She just might like to kill God images. Which makes it risky to be around her.
I assume because of John's reference to John, she had already done that, taken his head.
Yeah, in the imagination she had, yeah.
Wasn't there some conflict between John and Christ in that John didn't really want Christ to be preaching what he was bringing it out to the masses?
Yeah.
I don't know if that plays in there.
I doubt it.
At all. Okay.
It could, but I doubt it.
She just kills for the sake of it.
That's what he's realizing. She just kills for the fun of killing. And she happens to like killing princes.
She's an archetype of our Western myth. That's what you're saying.
I believe he's trying to reinstate her as a part of our cultural myth. Yes.
Is he asking there, Gary, he asked the question, who murdered the hero? Is this why Salome loves me? Do I love her, and did I therefore murder the hero? He's asking that of his own killing of Siegfried.
Siegfried, yeah. So he realizes Salome killed John, I killed Siegfried, am I Salome? Did I just kill the hero for the fun of it? Or is there a deeper meaning going on?
Yeah, but Jung didn't kill off the new God image, he killed off the old one.
Right.
The comparison puzzles me a bit.
Well, because it's the death of something important. And it bothers him that he's been involved with the death of something important. Even though it might be a meaningless importance in the historical perspective. it's still the death of something important. I think what that turns into eventually is that it's his job to give an alternative. She just kills. He kills, but then he feels guilty. She doesn't feel guilty. And out of his guilt, he creates Jungian psychology. I think that's what's at stake here.
She's an architect that just kills for pleasure.
Well,
and has no guilt, no.
At her current condition, yes.
That resonates what you just said. You know that it's his job to transform her kind of killing.
Mm-hmm.
Because before she's killed off a new God image,
mm-hmm.
we don't want her to do that
right.
again. So that really, that is the clearest explanation
yeah.
I can think of.
To your question, Jane, I think what we're dealing with, if we can step back, and this will become clear later. Remember, we're just getting started. He's trying to reinstate the importance of pleasure into life. And you say, well, don't we follow pleasure? Well, the church sure doesn't. None of the major religions do. We certainly don't follow it consciously, pleasure. So she would be the archetype of pleasure. But what he's realizing is that archetype of pleasure, it's not just about pleasure. It's also part one of a two-part process. And the part two of that process is pleasure leads you into life. And that's where you learn and mature who you are. But in that process, there's a death. Now, the way she's functioning now is highly destructive.
But divine.
Well, yes, divine, but that doesn't mean that she's not dangerous. It just means she's overpowering. And what he wants to try to do is to see, is there a way to humanize this whole process? That it doesn't have to be the death of a John the Baptist. Because left to her own, that's the way pleasure works. It just destroys what it consumes.
So this is all saying that the death of John the Baptist is the death of sin.
Yes.
Well, maybe it isn't.
Well, he's taking it as a bad thing because what he's concerned with is the shift from value system 1 to value system 2. And John is announcing a new value system.
Yes, but the Christ could not do his work with John there. Unfortunately, I mean, John was, first of all, people were saying that John was the Messiah, even though he himself was denying it. He was trying to influence the ministry of Christ. And then something acts upon him that's out of his control, gets him out of the way. And now there's all this freedom for the Christ who offers much more than John, who John said offered much more than he did, to be free and able to work in the world. So it's not... It might be divine in the sense that sometimes something has to go
this
way.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that makes sense. I think either way, though, what he's left with is how can the destructive part of this process, when it's lived out by an individual or a society, be as little destructive as possible? Make sense?
Yeah, I mean, if you take pleasure shadow as killing, just for the sake of killing.
Or devouring. Gobbling up.
Yeah. Just for the sake of doing that. I mean, but not, that's what it sounded like when you're saying anyway. But if you're doing, if you're trying to make that conscious and so that it comes into light, and then would only kill discriminately, or we can mm-hmm. with the meat.
Well, the death would be a right kind of death.
Yeah. Is that where we're going?
Yeah, I think so.
The salmonate, it was a justifiable death. It was a... It was an honor. It was that you are threatening me and my way of life, and you dissed my mom. So she wants you gone, and I'm here to do that for you. And I don't think she felt guilty because that's the way the world works then. And she had great power. Women didn't have that kind of power to say I want somebody killed. So she just took advantage of what was given to her. I don't think. Does she feel bad about it because she didn't think she was wrong?
No, I know she didn't feel bad.
So what did he do to the issue?
He said when her mother Herodias married her cousin or brother or whatever, I mean, it was this incestuous family that was really, and they were very debaucherous and wild parties all the time and stuff. And he said, you know what, Herodias, you really shouldn't do that. And it was like, you know, telling the wicked witch not to dip that apple. But she didn't have it. Herodias didn't have the power to say, I want something done with him. And Herod didn't care. So, you know, he was too busy having a good time. So he really didn't care. So she went to tell me that you have power. Use it. And she did. I don't find that
disturbing. Well, that's because you're not John the Baptist.
Yeah, but he should have known. I mean, that was stupid anyway. He's all surreptitious, you know, and he's baptizing people in private, and he's telling Jesus things in private, and, you know, I just want to live out in the wilderness. And then he goes to the biggest person in the world and has the most power to do something. But that's a bad idea. I mean, that is just stupid. In my opinion, it's what motivated you to do that now, John? There are locusts out there waiting for you, buddy. I mean, really, I just don't...
Where did you find him?
He came to, you know, he made this proclamation, and then he was invited to dinner. So, you know, he was hanging out in the city, just like Christ did. He knew it was dangerous. Salome said, I want John the Baptist, and here I said, woo, bigger party, you know, let's go get him. And then it was a big to-do.
I wonder if, I'm just formulating ideas on this music. This is really intriguing. That there's a personal aspect to it, and then there's an archetypal aspect.
Mm-hmm.
So when I think about this, I don't get into the personal dimension that you're talking about. And the way I'm imagining this is that I'm thinking about a goddess mythology that was overturned by a heroic mythology. Mm-hmm. So the hero turned and slayed the goddess. And then that mythology was overcome by monotheism. Now we have order, stultifying order that is totally sweeped out the goddess, which is this life and death natural round that goes on. And the hero played the goddess because they frankly were just sick of this, what they saw as willy-nilly death. They wanted to have some control over their life instead of feeling like they were in this process that they had no control over. So the hero shows up, that then goes into monotheism, which becomes this overly structured, which totally loses the goddess imagery, this idea of life and the natural force of life. And so now I look at Salome, who's turning to slay monotheism, but what she isn't understanding in each case is not that it's not slaying. What Jung comes to do in my mind is to see how to transform it in order to let both coexist. Letting the chaotic imagery of goddess mythology coexist with the ordered imagery of monotheism, because you need both. You need to be able to act on your instincts at the same time, and you need to have the capacity to work with those instincts in a way that best serves what he's saying to himself.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
So, if I think
it's,
of it,
it's about a shift in value systems.
Right, it's a total mythic shift that's going on that the individual lives out in these ways that I see as balancing this chaos and order. So, she's in the shadow feminine of the old goddess myth, which was the goddess disappeared. Things just come and go. Life just gives way to death, which gives way to new life. So, to me, it's interesting that now these two are
kind of up. Yeah. And left to her own, she just wants destruction.
Right.
He's trying to put her destruction in the context of transformation, as you said.
Right.
That's what he's starting with. He realizes if he lives her out directly, he's going to get destroyed. If he throws her away, he'll never get the death, which is part of transformation.
Right.
He's trying to say, how can we bring this into a multi-leveled process?
And Elijah's saying that we've always been together. You've always been both
yeah.
of us, but you're just now at a point where you can recognize that.
Right.
And monotheism, I mean, it brings an order, which is not an unhealthy thing. It just brings it in a way that totally sucks out instinct. And so you just live in structures that are self-defined. They kill life long before it's dead. Kind of the way I think about it.
Mm-hmm.
So it is interesting that those two are together and have been for eternity.
Yeah, it's an archetype. I think Jung would say.
But then in the footnote, he still, you know, he says, Salome, I was exceedingly doubtful about Salome, so I took to Elijah as being the most reasonable, for he seemed to have a mind.
Right.
So then he still wants to be with the rational, even many years later.
But soon, we're going to see that changes. She's going to end up with white hands instead of bloody hands.
And I think we all find ourselves wanting to go back to that rational hook when we find ourselves in the underworld. How do I make sense out of this? Put my mind to it. Do you realize that you have to let that go?
Just as a mythological reference, we hear... let me see. Footnote 161. I wanted to talk about maybe we're not there yet. These letters are so small I can't.
Oh, I can't.
No, we're not. Wait a minute.
Yeah, you're there.
Yeah, we are there.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at footnote 161, he refers to Simon Magus about halfway down. I thought I'd just give you a little spiel on him, because he is the original form of this archetype, or he represents an age-old form. Simon Magus is a biblical character who appears, and I don't know if I have the I don't have the biblical reference, but he's the one who offered the disciples money to be able to do the miracles. So simony is that word of like manipulating spiritual values for financial gain. So he's a bad guy in the New Testament. Not a bad guy, but a sleazy guy. The Gnostics took that figure and glorified him. And he fits into the Gnostic myth by way of the female part of the divinity. Remember the basic Gnostic pattern is the piece of God gets trapped in matter. In the particular version we're talking about, that part of God was called Ennoia. I think roughly, not unrelated to Sophia, different, but also a female. The female part of God gets trapped in matter and reincarnates several times until she becomes Helen of Troy, and then she becomes this Helen of Tyre, who is a prostitute. Simon Magus, wandering around, comes to this problem and rescues her. And they become friends and travel together. That Gnostically, that was seen as rescuing the piece of God caught in low matter and redeeming it. Does that make sense? So Jung is referring back to that image of Helen and Simon as a parallel to Salome and Elijah, to show that Salome as pleasure is something both rooted in the material aspect of life and also the part of God that's been lost. And again, you got the highest and the lowest together. That's what's going on in all of this stuff. Highest and lowest together. And there, Helen is explicitly a prostitute. And Simon, the wise man. And you see how what Gnosticism does is flip the Christian imagery from negative to positive. Suddenly, money and matter isn't evil as it was in the Christian story. Simon is now the good guy because Gnosticism glorifies the matter that Christianity eschews. Salome is that experience of pleasure in the material world which we have to learn not to exclude, because it's the gateway to Elijah, to wisdom, highest and lowest. So that's the worst part. Now he goes in. You have questions on that? That's the text we're going to be discussing now for a while. He'll be discussing.
He said highest and lowest gateway to?
To wisdom.
Wisdom.
As he would interpret that, you know, later, consciousness of the self comes through engagement in the world through your passions. You can't individuate on a mountaintop. You can't individuate in a brothel either. You have to bridge the two.
Salome embraces the embodied experience.
Yes.
And says there's value in embodiment.
Right.
That we're not embodied because nature is corrupt and we're
exactly
trying to get someplace else. We're embodied because there's value in that embodiment.
Right.
And through that embodiment, we become the conscious.
Right.
Increasing consciousness.
Yeah. Which is Elijah. I don't think she would say we embody it to come to consciousness. She would say we embody it because it's fun. And but what Jung is trying to get at, but her other half is Elijah. That's the one that says, like, that's the way to coming to consciousness.
I guess what I meant to say was that in that relationship, consciousness is born.
Yeah.
Because you can't. Either or.
Right. That's the whole point. That up to now we have made it an either or, but Jung is going back to this image where it wasn't separate. Because really one doesn't exist without the other. In the deepest human condition. In our language, spirit has instinct. Instinct has spirit. And spirit has instinct, but we've been so spiritual, we have to go to the instincts, most of us. Okay, are you all right so far? No one's had a stroke? Or it eases up for a while. Take a deep breath. Because he comments, this play is my play, not your play. Well, unfortunately, it is my play, Carl. He who enters into his own must grope through what lies at hand. That's the Salome world. Utterly poor, miserable, no humility to go through the gate. That's the humility it takes to live out Salome. Raw matter. Two forty-seven. The scene of the, oh, here we have a picture. Maybe you might want to kill that light, just because. Here's the three of them. I believe that must be Jung.
He's dressed as in a white initiate. That must be Elijah. Mm-hmm. That must be something. But this is what I find so interesting.
Mm-hmm. What?
It's an Eastern image.
Mm-hmm. You mean the architecture?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a mosque, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It looks a lot like one. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A mosque in the Alps? I don't know of any. But you see how his psyche is bringing this stuff together that we're dealing with now. Why would he paint a mosque there? Any other comments?
What are those things on top of
your head?
Yeah.
I
it's a cross
I think
on top.
Crosses.
Not on her. Hers looks more like a butterfly or something. No,
I don't know what it is on top of hers. Can you tell, Carol?
It appeared to be a butterfly. I mean, it's not very well defined. Of course, it's incredibly minuscule if you think about the size of that actual painting. You can tell that his is a cross, but hers, the best I can do, is a butterfly.
Well, if it were a butterfly, that would be the soul.
Definitely not a square.
I'm wondering if it's that dragonfly that we saw in the cave.
That's you.
Oh, that's you. I think it's you. Who else would it be?
Yeah.
And he... What he's drawing there, which we don't know in the book, is that he's an initiate.
Mm-hmm. She's in red.
Mm-hmm. Light blue, spiritual.
It's interesting, those colors at the top, after the red and the blue get less changed color and transforms into lighter blue and pink and then maybe gold.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, they come
red, blue, gold, huh?
And the whole thing is surrounded by writhing snakes.
Mm-hmm.
He said the snake was the bridge.
It was a black snake.
Yeah. That's an octopus. I don't know if you can see where Jane's head is. Oh, is the eye of the octopus, which I think is Salome, and how it's woven together with the blue over here, the star symbol of Elijah. That's where I went with that. That they are joined together.
That's a love so below.
Yeah, that's what Kathy just said.
Oh, yeah. Looks like an octopus, she said.
Yeah.
Maybe that circle is what's supposed to be over her head because the cross is in the blue part.
Well, there is a serpent there underneath Salome and Elijah.
Is there?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Black serpent.
Mm-hmm. There it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there is the same symbol. He has the cross that Barbara was saying, and it looks like hers is just a circle that matches the red octopus.
If you look at the file, it doesn't look like a circle at all.
No.
But isn't that a snake fin on the
left? Don't be worth blowing that up, fine.
Because that's not a continuation of the octopus.
What, on your...
Yeah, I'll try to make a slide just of her head, see if I can get it.
Yeah,
that'd
be good.
On your unshopped images.
It would be there.
As close as you can get with the photo you took.
Okay, I'll do that. Well, how far?
That red moon over there. On the sky.
I think that's like that midnight sun we saw in the cave.
Okay.
Oh. Yeah, because remember he says I'm underground. Get me out of here. Did he paint it on the top of a mountain, sort of? Well, I hope you can feel how important it is. And it's worth the effort, because it's just the beginning. some of this stuff now we'll go through. The commentary, I think we don't have to linger on sentence by sentence, but I think the active imaginations, when they're this important, will go very slowly on. So we stopped at the top of 247, and we'll pick up with this is the scene of the mystery. And so you had to read to 250. I don't think we'll get anywhere near that. Just in case we get on the roll, why don't you read to really to the end. What is that? How far do I have to read again?
251.
And it's 250. It goes to
255.
But 255 is footnotes, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just read to 254. I'll worry about the footnotes. Don't worry about the footnotes. Well, if you want to worry about the footnotes, but I'm just trying to pick out the ones that really are important for the story.
And by fun, she means torture. You understand?
Torture is the new fun. Okay, thank you. See you in two. And that'll be the last one before summer.